Hi folks, Chris Roberts here. Before we get started, I just wanted to take a moment, if I could just tug on your coat sleeve and just take a little bit of your time to ask you to help support a worthy cause. This April is marking the third annual Reviews for Good campaign put forth by the amazing folks over at Podchaser, and I'm once again reaching out to ask you all to help. From April 1st through April 30th, for every review that gets left on the Podchaser website, the company will donate 25 cents to the World Central Kitchen, which in turn this year is funding Chefs for Ukraine. They are actively involved in feeding families who are fleeing from the conflict currently going on there. As we speak, the WCK has a presence in over 12 Ukrainian cities, as well as in several of the neighboring countries, and continues to both work to feed Ukrainians and refugees that are coming out of the war. It seems pretty simple, right? Well, actually, it is. Seriously, here's how it works. You just go to podchaser.com, you make yourself a free Podchaser account, and that lets you be a listener, and you can commence to reviewing some of your favorite shows, or even episodes of your favorite shows. To count as a review, all you have to do is leave feedback that is a minimum of 20 characters in length. 20 characters? That's nothing! And the only other caveat is it has to be unique. You can't keep spamming your reviews. You know, you can't keep submitting things like, "I love Chris, he's so handsome, he's so sexy, and so smart," over and over again. But that's it. And what's more, here's the great news. You can leave as many reviews as you like. Plus, as an added bonus, when the podcasts you review leave a response back to anything that you left them, Podchaser will double the donation, making it then 50 cents per review. There's so many great podcasts out there. Please feel free to check them all out, especially on the Apodalypse group list that you can see at podchaser.com. Or, you know, you can go back through yours truly's own back catalog, and you could just go to town reviewing all your favorite episodes. Remember, in doing this, you're only slightly helping me, slightly helping podcasters, but in reality, you are absolutely helping to feed those who are truly hungry and in need. So I beg you, please, what are you waiting for? Get out there and leave some reviews today. Thank you for your time.
We thought it would be funny if our Bob, dressed as a policeman, would tell a perfect stranger that her husband is dead.
Yes.
Mrs. Cecily Barth?
Yes.
Your husband's name was Stephen Barth?
Was. What do you mean was?
Did your husband drive a 1978 Chevrolet Impala?
What are you saying? Has something happened to my Stephen? Tell me.
Now watch her reaction to the bad news.
I'm afraid so.
I think it's time for Mrs. Barth to be let in on the fun, don't you?
Mrs. Barth, look across the street at that van behind me. Look really carefully.
Is that a...
It's a Camry, yes.
Wait a minute. You mean...
Yes, Mrs. Barth. You're on...
Statistic Hidden Videos? And you're Bob. You're Bob. I'm on TV.
I saw it on Linden Street. Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater as we once again dig into a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review, rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with a little bit of background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review, subscribe. Our April theme of TV Party, it's drawing to a close. That's been our selection of films that feature some really fun television shenanigans. And this week, the LSCE goes with some offbeat dark comedy as we screen the 1992 cult classic, Stay Tuned. Join us! This week's film is one that I saw as a rental back in the day. It was a regular old Friday night sojourn that we took to the local Blockbuster Video, and then we all came back, and all the siblings and I gathered around, and we took in a rather weird tale about a family man who watches a little bit too much TV, and ends up getting sucked into it along with his wife. If memory serves, I recall my father not being that impressed by it, and my kid brother being rather indifferent to it all. But there was something about it that I just couldn't shake. I thought it was a lot of fun, and I really rather liked the dark streak of the humor that it displayed, which, honestly, in hindsight, is most likely why my dad wasn't probably thrilled about it. It just became one of those things. You know, you see it, it goes back into the back of your mind, and then you promptly forget about all of it. That is, until I went to college, where I revisited the film again as a rental and cemented my love for the picture as a goofy bit of fun. Which caused me, of course, to double down on just how strange this offering was. But honestly, if we're going to talk about this week's film, we first have to talk about what its development initially was. In reality, a cinematic bribe to woo one Mr. Tim Burton. So what you have here is a classic case of a studio realizing that they made a gigantic mistake when it came to dealing with a talented director, and subsequently going out of their way to try to make, in a very ham-fisted fashion, an attempt to steer them back to a project that they think can make them all money. I get it, of course. Filmmaking, while it is an art, is still a business at its core. But it's these people who are not really the creatives when they attempt to second guess what one of their creative talents would find interesting. Well, in those cases, you get some really strange setups, the likes of which often make for, at best, interesting projects. And more often than not, it leads to some rather mediocre material. And that's, of course, where I come in with my love of bad B films. And honestly, that's where the good folks at Morgan Creek Productions found themselves. You see, MCP were themselves a subsidiary of Warner Brothers, and they were trying to come up with a project that they could dangle in front of one Tim Burton, a man who, by all accounts, Warner Brothers had treated rather shabbily during his time making the 1989 blockbuster Batman, micromanaging and second-guessing the poor man's every move. After that was a success, when he came back to them with his idea for what would become Edward Scissorhands, the powers that be decided it was just too risky a prospect, it would cost too much money, they weren't willing to take a gamble on him. And so, they ended up selling off their interest in the picture to 20th Century Fox, and they bankrolled Burton, and of course, it was a huge hit. So, smarting from passing on something that they already held in their hands and absolutely could have had money with, Morgan Creek Productions wanted to have something to offer up to Tim Burton to get him back in good graces. And so, they commissioned the writing team of Jim Jennewine and Thomas S. Parker to develop something for them. Now, I'll tell you this, Jennewine and Parker were not, let's call them men of letters. They both actually got their start as ad men who decided to try a hand at script writing, and they sort of fell into the business. But one can't argue that they didn't leave an indelible mark on the early 1990s, as a large number of their scripts would indeed get made. And, what's more, they would make a mint off of it in the process, penning adaptations of things like The Flintstones and Richie Rich, and this will really throw you elder millennials for a loop, the infamously bad Getting Even with Dad. Oof. That's a real train wreck there. You got Macaulay Culkin and Ted Danson trying to do some sort of comedic turn. Ugh. But in the process, they ended up creating a little story here about a husband and a wife who get sucked into their TV and have to deal with some horror comedy parodies of popular TV shows. They were able to sell this little script over to Warner Brothers for a cool $750,000. Hey, that's nice work if you can get it. They called the first draft of this Terror Vision, before they of course swapped it to then being Stay Tuned. And it was something that Warner Brothers and Morgan Creek had hoped would spark an interest in Tim Burton. So they came calling, asking the director, hey, why don't you make this quirky little television film that we have? And Burton's dry response at that point was, the only way I would even consider such a thing is if you gave me full creative control over the next Batman sequel. Now, Batman was a huge blockbuster in its own right, and these are people who like money. So Burton, instead, is quickly off making a Batman picture, Batman Returns, with all the toots and the whistles that he requested, and a project like Stay Tuned that was meant to get his attention, that was quickly forgotten both by Warner Brothers and by Burton himself. But as luck would have it, another director had come across the script and had read it and loved it. One Mr. Peter Hyams. Now, Peter Hyams himself had a really interesting and varied career. He's a director that has dabbled in a number of different types of genres: drama, romance, horror, action, comedy, sci-fi, and while all of his various projects have had different levels of success, there's almost always a through-line element of having some sort of niche and unique cult appeal, at least when it comes to the stories that he seems to choose to film. He was a director that was behind such greats as 1978's Capricorn 1, 1981's Outland, oh, that's a fantastic movie, and the unnecessary but visually thrilling 2010, The Year We Make Contact, in 1984. And of course, the buddy comedy Running Scared in 1986, and then the action thriller The Presidio in 1988. So honestly, depending on your opinions of some of his past work, Hyams taking an interest in this script can either be regarded as a somewhat dubious honor, but the director liked what he saw here, and he thought this would be a great chance to make some dark, yet still very funny, parody. Morgan Creek would end up putting up a budget of $25 million, and in one of the first moves that Hyams would make was he would reach out and personally contact artist, cartoonist, director Chuck Jones and ask him if he would be willing to work on an animated sequence for this picture, knowing full well that it would take over 6 months for that sort of thing to even be completed. Jones himself was appreciative of the project, and he took this commission seriously, bringing the quality and the skill that a Warner Brothers production would have, and what's more, what a classic cartoon would warrant. When it came to casting for this picture, the studio had first wanted to have a strong comedic lead, so they reached out to Dan Aykroyd to play the part of Roy. But Aykroyd himself was already overextended. He was wrapping up shooting the biopic Chaplin with Robert Downey Jr., and he was just starting to go on to the film set of Sneakers. Oh, that's another favorite. That's going to be a future episode for sure. So, all that said, he was out and could not commit. The studio followed up and decided they wanted star names, and so they cast Richard Dreyfuss, and he would come on board paired with Tracy Ullman. That is, until both of them would walk away from the project when Warner Brothers decided to try to lowball them and pay them less of a salary than they initially had demanded. So who does that leave them with? Well, John Ritter was next on the list to be approached, and he was already having a bit of a box office comeback since he had just finished starring in Problem Child. And this was another crack at him taking a shot at some fun comedy. Now, I must say as a side note, I've been going through various articles as I've been doing research on this week's episode, and I must say, I kind of hate reading the current Gen Z myopia when it comes to John Ritter as a subject. Article after article keeps bemoaning that he should have done more movies, he should have focused on having a big film career, instead of plugging away at being part of television projects. For those of you who bother to do a little digging, this is often where people reference his time as being on Hooperman, and, you know, that is what it was. I don't hate that show. John Ritter as a cop who solves crimes, I'm for it, that's great. But honestly, this is what drives me a little bit nutty, because Ritter, after his post-8-year turn where he played Jack Tripper, seven of which were on Three's Company, and then the subsequent 1 year after where he starred as Tripper in Three's A Crowd, the spin-off show, he did try to have a film career. He paired with Neil Israel for the spoof, and again, future episode, in 1979's Americathon, and he followed that up as an actor who moonlights as a real crime fighter in the 1980 comedy Hero at Large. And then, after that, he decided to do a prestige piece. He shot They All Laughed in 1981 for Peter Bogdanovich. And then he followed that up with Real Men with Jim Belushi. So, here's the problem. John Ritter made movies. The issue was that a lot of the projects that he ended up associated with were not hits. At least not until 1990, when Problem Child made bank at the box office, much to everyone's surprise. Ritter was, in my opinion, squandered in the number of projects that he was in. And more's the pity, because some of those movies I just read off to you are really good movies. They just didn't make money, and people didn't see them. And again, he was often paired with really talented people. It's just that what he was working with was rather mediocre, and that kept him from having a larger star presence, I feel. Still, Ritter, when it came to this film, fit the bill for Price, and Warner Brothers decided that they wanted to pair him with another television pro, the great Pam Dauber, of Mork and Mindy fame, and of course to a lesser extent, My Sister Sam. Their chemistry was undeniable when they read together, and they both really had a great way of playing off of each other. And thus, you can throw in some fantastic character work from actors like Jeffrey Jones, who were still riding high from being Principal Rooney on Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And this, of course, was years away from his tragic fall from grace due to his child pornography charges. Here, we have him playing a demonic programming director for Hellavision, in the role of Mr. Spike. Couple that with the inclusion of a wisecracking Eugene Levy of SCTV fame, and you have a pretty strong main ensemble. Not to mention the fact that you throw in cameos and bit parts from guys like Don Calfa, Captain Lou Albano, Don Pardo, and of course rap group Salt and Pepper, and you have the makings of a lot of fun here. I will say, for the segment where they parodied Saturday Night Live for the Dwayne's World, Hyams actually had convinced the real Mike Myers and Dana Carvey to come on board and play demonic versions of themselves for the spoof of Saturday Night Dead. But during filming, the project was happening during the fall of 1991, and that's right when both Mike Myers and Dana Carvey were working on post-production for their own big-screen adaptation of Wayne's World, one where Myers found himself locked in a protracted battle over editing with director Penelope Spheeris, causing the two comedians to have to back out of their cameo and actually be replaced by other actors filling in for them. But just knowing that, man, wouldn't that have been interesting to see? Filming for Stay Tuned took place between October of 1991 and lasted through January of 1992, with the majority of the scenes shot up in British Columbia, doubling for Seattle, while, of course, the spaghetti western pieces were filmed in Arizona. Cast and crew reportedly had a really great time on set, noting that with all of the various channels and themes, it was like being on a new film each day, and thus the variety made for a lot of fun. But all that being said, folks, you've been listening to me flap my jaws long enough. How's about I shut up and we get to that trailer? What do you say?
Sorry to disturb you at this hour, but I have something you want.
A new TV?
It broadcast programs no one had ever seen.
Wednesday at 9, don't miss an all-new episode of The Silencer of the Lambs.
Then one night, Roy and Helen Nabel got sucked in and discovered that hell is one TV show after another.
Let's welcome our new contestants, Roy and Helen Nabel.
And they're starring in every show.
I've watched enough wrestling to know one thing. It's all fake. No one ever gets...
Not fake.
So the object...
The object, Mr. Pierce, is to kill them before they reach the end.
Oh, my God. We're cartoons.
I am not a mouse. I'm Helen Nabel. I have two beautiful children.
Mom? Our parents are trapped in television.
Now, they can't go home. They can only switch channels.
Where did he go?
Hey, lady, watch out!
And every series is a nightmare.
That's entertainment.
Because Satan is the sponsor.
Okay, everybody, head spins. Very good, very nice.
Well, time to rock and roll.
This comedy from hell.
Whee! Party time! It's the end of it!
That'll save her.
Not!
Stay tuned.
Where have you been?
We open on the middle-aged Seattle couple, Mr. and Mrs. Murray Seidenbaum, as played by Bob Dishy and Joyce Gordon, about to spend another lethargic evening together in front of the TV, preparing to consume an oversized amount of popcorn. Just then, a mysterious hooded figure comes knocking at their front door, offering Murray an incredible opportunity. After he's been missing for a bit of time, Mrs. Seidenbaum goes searching in the backyard for her husband. That is, before lights flash and she ends up screaming over the film's titles. We then get the breakdown on another local family in the same neighborhood, the Nabels, as narrated by their son, Daryl, as played by David Tom. His dad, Roy, as played by John Ritter, is a rather broken man, hating his job as a plumbing salesman, and who is failing in his marriage to his more successful advertising executive wife, Helen, as played by Pam Dauber. This happens while he's also neglecting time with his children, Daryl, and his daughter, Diane, as played by Heather McComb, to instead lose himself in the comfort and escape that is offered by television.
My name is Daryl Nabel. I'm a pretty normal kid who led a pretty normal life. Until that night.
It looks and feels natural, whether you're skimming the surf at 30 knots or racing the wind on a cruiser for two.
And remember, we stand behind it. And by the way, I'm not only the heckler president, but I'm also a client.
In describing my dad, several names come to mind. Bill Cosby, Alan Thicke, the father on the Brady Bunch. My dad watched all of them. In fact, he watched anything on TV all the time. They say the average American watches 7.5 hours of TV a day. If that's true, there are two guys who never watch, and my dad took their times. My mom was a big deal advertising executive with a vitamin company. My dad had this real suck job selling plumbing supplies. I heard them arguing one night, and she said he was suffering from something called a midlife crisis, whatever that is. He said he wasn't. She said he was jealous of her success. He said he wasn't. They argued a lot. So that's my dad. going to his pretty normal home after his pretty normal day at a suck job, ready to watch his TV. That brings us to that night I was talking about. That's when everything changed.
It wasn't always like this, though. Before life ground him down, Roy was this dynamic guy who had big dreams. He was a fencing champion in college, but working to help support his family and then seeing the success that his wife had while his own career stagnated, he now finds himself addicted to the escape that TV offers him. And he watched anything and everything, sports, old movies, sitcoms, just to cut through the tedium of his own existence. Picking up on the growing problems between their parents and worried about their marriage, both of the Nabel children purposely arranged to be out of the house and staying over with friends on a particular Friday night, hoping it will give their folks a chance to reconnect, something that Helen is actually all for. The problem is, when she suggests that they take a weekend away to a remote cabin, Roy is just too obsessed with his love of basketball to take her seriously, which causes an understandable fight.
Take it to the high post, the high post.
Roy? I have an idea.
Oh, God, great, congrats. You know how proud I am of you. Pass it, pass it.
Let's go away.
Okay, honey, you go ahead. I'll be there in 4 minutes and 16 seconds.
Roy.
Yeah.
Roy.
Yeah.
Let's go away like we used to the mountains.
Okay.
Just the two of us.
Great.
No phones, no kids, no TV.
No TV?
They don't have TV there.
Is there a plug?
This is abnormal. Honey, you're just shutting yourself off from everything and everybody. Are you having problems? Is it me?
Yes! No.
Is it work? Are you having trouble at work?
Work, of course not. What makes you say something like that?
Shoot, you idiot, shoot!
The guy's just...
The one thing we always promised each other is that we would remain honest.
Honey, we are honest with each... Look. You say that I'm shut off, that I can't open up to you, that I'm closed down. Okay, well, I'm gonna tell you something that's... very important to me, and I'm going to be completely honest. I don't want you to take this the wrong way.
Oh, Roy, talk to me. I can take anything.
We're in double overtime here.
Fine. Watch TV.
Thanks, sweetheart. Could you mind moving just a second?
This is unbelievable. You couldn't do it, could you? You couldn't listen to me for 2 minutes without that stupid television being on. When I married you, you were a doer. And now all you are is a watcher.
Mr. Johnson tried to hit the trailer. He gave it away to Drexler. Drexler fouled at midcourt. Fouls on Derek McKee. Drexler plays through.
All right.
Huh.
Helen, for her part, ends up hurling a fencing trophy through Roy's prize TV. And then leaves to run some errands, causing Roy to have to cope with getting the portable TV out and deal with the small size. As he's struggling to watch further television, Roy is disturbed by a visitor at the front door, and he opens to meet Mr. Spike, as played by Jeffrey Jones, a salesman who tells Roy that he's been specially selected to receive a very special television offer. One that won't cost him any money down.
What exactly is it that you're selling?
Attractive, the little woman. You two having difficulties?
Well, I don't see how
I know all about you, Roy. Success. It's like a fly buzzing around your head. You reach for it, you grab it, and all you get is nothing. You're tired of nothing, Roy. And so you just want to hide from everything in here. But she gives you hate, right? Roy, wait till she gets a load of this. 666 channels of heart-pounding, skull-blasting entertainment. Comedy, drama, hot oil aerobics, like nothing you've ever seen, brother. Unlimited entertainment snatched from the ether and slammed into your brand-new 44-inch, 900-line resolution, three-way expanded matrix Dolby stereo TV, right? Here, Roy.
A new TV?
Straight from the Temple of High Tech. Make this thing look like a Philco, you know? Some people would give their souls for a system like this, figuratively speaking. We'll just sign here, and we're in business.
night, Mr. Nabel.
Did I mention,
free trial?
Free?
A gigantic satellite dish is installed in the Nabler's backyard, and Mr. Spike leaves satisfied, laughing maniacally that his job is done. Helen arrives home and is most put out to discover a new gigantic entertainment system taking up their living room, and she runs upstairs in a huff to begin to pack her things. Roy, for his part, heads outside to adjust the dish to get better reception, and as he's futzing with his new toy, Helen comes out to yell at him once more, announcing that she will be leaving him. As they argue, neither of them notice that the dish has come online by itself and seems to be targeting them specifically, only to catch on far too late when it blasts them with a ray that sucks them into the dish and on a journey through a complex wired system of cables before they're plopped into a sadistic game show, appropriately titled You Can't Win. While the Nabels struggle, we shift inside to the corporate office of Hellavision, where demonic sycophant Crowley, as played by Eugene Levy, is breaking in the new hire Pierce, as played by Eric King. Mr. Spike enters and is notified by a programming demon named Wetzel, as played by Don Calfa, that the time is finally up on the Seidenbaums, and the entire viewing room watches as the couple, on a trip to Tokyo, have to contend with the sudden arrival of a Godzilla-like kaiju, one that seemingly crushes the couple underfoot. Spike, not enjoying Pierce's reaction, lays everything out for him.
Crunch him up. The Seidenbaums. Yearning for exotic locales. This episode takes them to Tokyo. They're having a wonderful time, starring in their own movie. It's the Seidenbaums versus the gigantic stinky-footed lizard! Oh! Sayonara, Mrs. Seidenbaum.
Entertainment.
Oh, he's good. He's so good.
Shocking.
Sir, this is Pierce, our new intern.
Mr. Pierce, if you can't stomach the sight of blood...
It's not the blood I find distressing. It's your lack of subtext.
Film school graduate.
Yes, sir. USC. I did my thesis on Kurosawa and Spike Lee.
Mr. Pierce, let me educate you about our organization. Here at Hellvision, we've turned the process of soul acquisition into an entertainment extravaganza, and all for the benefit of one very demanding viewer below.
The boss himself, and I don't mean Springsteen.
He has an enormous appetite for misfortune. It is our job to supply him with an eclectic offering of light amusements. No subjects!
You see, Hellvision employees have to monitor souls that are at stake throughout the dish world. If the zapped-in viewers survive a 24-hour period, they of course are out of their service contract that they signed to keep their immortal souls. So Spike ends up taking offense to Crowley when he notes that in the past there was a single person who did manage to get out. So in retribution, he sends him off to do, quote, field work and throws him into the system itself. The Nabels end up surviving their time on the game show, winning the prize of whatever's behind door number one, which itself turns out to be a gateway to another channel, one that is dedicated to pro wrestling. Finding themselves suddenly decked out in garish costumes, they're forced to have a tag team fight against another married couple, the Gorgons, which, to Roy's horror, the violence is very real. He takes a serious beating at the hands of both of the Gorgons until Helen starts fighting dirty and actually wins the match. The kids come home in the morning and marvel at all of the new entertainment setup that's in the living room, but since their parents are gone, they assume that their plan worked, and they won't be coming home until that evening, prompting Diane to invite a bunch of her girlfriends over and having Daryl sit down to watch some of the rather strange programming that's available on the new television set. The Nabels are swept over to yet another channel, this time being on Northern Overexposure, where they meet a desperate Crowley, digging in the snow, trying to find a break in the conduit, something that he explains will allow them to get out of this freezing nightmare and hopefully into another channel, where things are more comfortable and far less deadly. While they're talking, a pack of wolves arrives and forces the three to sprint into an ice fishing shack where they hole up for safety, evaluating what has actually happened to them.
Let me get this straight. We've been sucked into some kind of a TV world?
Are you saying that that salesman was Mr. Spike? Mephistopheles of the cathode ray. Big brother to the ungrateful dead. And let me tell you, if we ever cross channels again, ho, ho, ho.
Roy, how could you do this?
I didn't know this was part of the deal. I thought I was buying a TV.
This is just great. This is great. You wanted to live in a TV fantasy? Well, you got your wish.
Look on the bright side. At least we're not dead.
No, not yet. Stay alive another 15 hours. Bingo. Free pass back to reality. Of course, the odds of making it are about one in a... Oh, my. The cold's no place for a stiff.
Oh, my God.
No, don't panic. I got us into this. I'll get us out.
Oh, you'll get us out. Your leadership skills couldn't get us out of a T-shirt.
After some time of waiting, it appears the wolves have gone, and the three venture outside to walk towards the dug exit, only to have Crowley be set upon and mauled by the pack who were hiding. The Nables run back to the shack, but in the scuffle to close the door, they end up knocking over the kerosene lamp, which sets the entire building on fire. Roy decides they can push the building from the inside towards the conduit hole, and the plan works. That is, until the back of the shack falls off from being on fire and allows the hungry wolves to enter in. Roy ends up holding the predators off with a hatchet while Helen escapes first, and then he awkwardly squeezes himself through, and the two land into a cartoon universe where they themselves have been turned into rather cute animated mice.
Couldn't be any worse, huh, Roy?
Helen? Oh my God! We're cartoons! Boy, this is strange.
Strange? I'm an animated rodent wearing high-heeled running shoes. The word strange is somehow lacking.
At least we're safe here. No one ever dies in cartoons, right?
Oh, Ralph, I left some food out. I hope it doesn't attract any mice while we're gone.
Don't worry. That new device we bought is guaranteed. No rodent stands a chance in there.
Stay tuned.
How can you even think of eating donuts at a time like this?
What should I do? Look for some oat bran? I'm starved.
If you don't come down here this instant, I'm leaving.
Where are you gonna go? Your cartoon mother's house?
I am warning you, Roy! Roy?
Wow. These things are as big as Buicks.
I'm gone. That's it. I said we're through, and we are through. I can do better on my own. I am not a mouse. I am not a mouse. I'm Helen Nable. I have an MBA. I live at 1532 Blue Jay Court. I have two beautiful children who I may never see again.
Mom?
The calm of being animated mice is interrupted by the arrival of a robot cat, who subsequently chases the pair around the house and shoots at them, trying to destroy them. Daryl ends up catching the show and begins to realize that he's somehow watching his parents on TV stuck in a cartoon, based upon their voices and, most importantly, upon their constant bickering. Roy manages to defeat the cat, but it just reactivates, having 8 more lives to go. Roy ends up then stealing a Barbie car from the animated house's dollhouse, and he throws Helen through a conduit gate that he finds, staying trapped in the cartoon, fighting the cat further, ultimately defeating it by using cartoon logic, where he orders a robot dog from the Acme company to take care of the cat, which in turn allows him to search for Helen across the channels. He goes through another conduit doorway and has to endure a short stay on a show Saturday Night Dead with zombified hosts Dwayne and Garf of Dwayne's Underworld. That is, before he finds himself now in a noir detective film from the 1940s.
I'm black and white.
Hello. Testing? Testing?
Roy Nabel, private dick. Better than being a public dick. Okay. Okay, I'm in some old movie. Must be on cable. I've been watching these things my whole life. I should know what to do. Be like Bogart. Yeah, that's it, like in The Maltese Falcon. I'm on a case. I gotta find Helen. Gotta find the clues. Gotta find out how to use this thing.
Mr. Nabel, you've dropped your gun again.
I know!
Roy ends up tracking clues, and he finds out that some gangsters have abducted Helen and are holding her at a club run by none other than Murray Seidenbaum. Murray, in this channel, has remade himself into a big-time gangster. He brought his own remote with him when he was sucked into the dish, and thus he's had the ability to shift between channels when things go wrong. Hence, that's how he survived the Godzilla attack. He wants Helen to stay with him and be his gal in this new reality. And as Roy comes in to rescue her, a rival gang also arrives and begins to shoot up the club. Seidenbaum is killed, and the Nabels are able to take his remote and change the channels, putting themselves in a historical miniseries set in the French Revolution, entitled Off With His Head. In this reality, they run into Crowley, who has survived his ordeal with the wolves, although he's missing several limbs from his time there, and he assures them that all they have to do is survive another mere 2 hours, and they will be out.
Mom and Dad, where are you?
And now, the all-new miniseries about the French Revolution, Off With His Head, the story of the Marquis de Nabel, an enemy of the people, who tries to escape the guillotine by wearing a disguise. It's an epic drama of love, danger, and cross-dressing.
Right. You have boobs.
Hey, Nabels.
Nice disguise.
Crowley?
Interesting concept, diagonal boobs.
Could you fix that thing? Thought the wolves got you.
Yeah? Let me tell you something about wolves. Vicious? Absolutely, goes without saying. But not that bright. While those dumb bunnies were fighting over a couple of my appendages, I managed to escape.
Liberté, citizen! Vive la France! Power to les people! Come on.
Only 2 hours left, and your 24 hours are up. All you gotta do is lie low. That's it. Like cops, inside, inside. I'll find a conduit out of here. Bonjour. Nice day for an execution. No?
Stay tuned for the final chapter of Off With His Head, when the Marquis de Nabel finally loses his.
Uh-oh. Merci.
Well, we've always wanted to go to Paris.
In the 20th century.
As long as we're here, we might as well make the best of it.
Make the best of it? This is the French Revolution. People are trying to kill you in case you haven't noticed.
Helen, if we ever get out of this, things are going to be different, I promise you. I'm not just going to be a watcher. I'm going to be the man I was when we first met.
You weren't blonde then, and you wore a lot less makeup.
By this time, Daryl is able to convince his sister that their parents are somehow in the TV. And he hijacks the satellite signals, which allows him to use his own recording equipment to attempt to talk to his parents. Roy and Helen are caught by a crowd of revolutionaries accusing them of being aristocrats on the run. And as they're led off to the guillotine to be executed, Daryl, talking into the system, is able to convince all of the peasants who hear his voice that he is in fact the voice of God. And so the Nabels are spared right at the end when their 24 hours are up. Spike himself is furious and doesn't want to admit to Satan that he's lost another soul and face the consequences, so he uses a technicality. He has to let Roy go due to the fact that they themselves have a contract, but he's under no obligation to give Helen back. She was collateral damage. So, if Roy wants her and her immortal soul, he's going to have to come back in and get his wife himself. Spike announces that he will be waiting for Roy on Channel 1, which is a spaghetti western set, where he has tied Helen to some train tracks and has armed the entire setup with some dynamite. Roy exits into the backyard, and while he thanks his kids for their help, he takes the family remote control and he dives back into the dish to save Helen. Roy and Spike then engage in a series of battles across numerous channels, starting with a gunfight that damages Roy's remote, and then jumping into a Three Musketeers-esque set where the two engage in a prolonged sword fight. Spike was not counting on Roy having skill, and during their fight, they end up being zapped again into HTV, the MTV parody in Hellavision, where they're in a Salt and Peppa video for the very real song Start Me Up, each of them attempting to dance their way through the shot and collect the remaining remote as it becomes passed between various backup dancers. Salt and Peppa themselves end up holding the controller, and they, being good characters in this scenario, give the remote to Roy, who promptly uses it to zap Spike back to the 15th century castle while he heads over to Channel 1 to free Helen. The entire Nabal family ends up reconciling on the back lawn, free from the trap of being in the dish. While they embrace, the neighbor's overly aggressive Rottweiler gets out and charges the family, but it ends up getting sucked into the dish before the structure melts down and disappears back into the earth. Spike ends up being at the mercy of Crowley, who feeds his former boss to the vicious Rottweiler dog, while Pierce ends up taking over running things at Hellavision. Roy and Helen fix their marriage, and he quits the job that he hates. Roy has learned his lesson, and now he only watches TV sparingly, and when he does, it's just for the news. He opens his own business, a fencing school, where he warns his students to be careful not to pay too much attention to what they see on TV, reminding them that it can get you into a lot of trouble. As credits roll. So where do we even begin? Well, let me talk about what works here. And for me, there's a lot. I mean, it's a film that has lots of smart jokes that are thrown in with a lot of seemingly overly simplistic parody. And I think that's what makes it get dismissed so quickly. People don't take the time to look. I personally love the concept that hell is portrayed as a corporate structure here. And as an idea, that in itself is nothing new. I mean, yeah, it makes sense, but this is something that's been around for a good long time. You could just go back and read the classic C.S. Lewis story, The Screwtape Letters, to see that the concepts of demons operating with some sort of structure works. No, I like the fact here that the demons themselves treat and abuse each other in a sort of hierarchy fashion. And it's a novel ideal, but when you watch it now, it's important to note that from the gate, this is a good two decades out before we would see things like Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell. Again, a show I very much enjoy, but it sort of feels like it picked up the baton as a natural progression for what was already established when it comes to a film like Stay Tuned. The remote control gags. When we see characters accidentally muting themselves or struggling to fix things as they adjust the remote itself, that's gold. The Chuck Jones segment, of course, it's masterful, both with its self-awareness and then just coupled with the pure quality of the animation that is offered here, it makes for a very smart tongue-in-cheek moment of levity. For my money, though, one of the funniest meta moments that's offered up in this picture is when Roy Nabal is zapped into the Three's Company set. And I have to push, it's not a hellish version of Three's Company, it's the regular show that Ritter was on, which causes the man to scream in terror as a faux Chrissy and a faux Janice burst into the room and start to demand that Roy explain just where he's been, before he quickly extracts himself from the sitcom. On that note too, let me try here now to segue, to take a moment and praise the cast. Ritter and Dauber are great here. they take on a bunch of TV tropes like two seasoned professionals would. Clearly, they're enjoying the irony of having been on popular sitcoms for so long, and now they get to poke fun at that. Both of them get to have moments that are quite silly, and it allows them to be in on the joke when it comes to this project. Jones, for his part, is great as a growling corporate demon, doubling down on some of that intensity that he brought in some earlier villain roles, stuff like Howard the Duck, but in this case he's not using a crazy voice. But truly, my favorite scene stealer comes with Eugene Levy, because he gets to have all of the fun throwaway lines. He gets to be this sleazy, obnoxious corporate yes man, all at the same time while not knowing exactly when he should keep his mouth shut, which makes the scenes he shows up in ever so much fun.
Trust me, babe, you lucked into the right place. Very cushy down here. I mean, you can cool your heels in here for the rest of eternity, if you kiss the right ass. And let me tell you, these lips ain't calloused for nothing.
Some kind of comedian?
Ah, I once opened for Liberace in Vegas.
Great.
Ah, this is the Jumbotron. Beauty, isn't it? It's got all the bells and whistles. This is our official scoreboard. Keeps track of the SBIs. Souls batted in. Kind of a sports thing.
I would be remiss if I didn't also mention the parodies themselves, because they play into things later, like when it would come to criticism. They're rather hit or miss depending on if you were a viewer of a show that they actually mock, but there's a certain surrealism that we have already seen that comes in with other movies, stuff that UHF had parodied before, that sort of permeates the comedic sensibility of this film. Or hey, let me rephrase it to you. Do you enjoy Rick and Morty and like the concept of interdimensional cable? What you're watching here is basically proto-interdimensional cable, just not as cutting or as weird that animation can provide. The Star Trek parody is well done. The Driving Miss Daisy segment, which is driving over Miss Daisy, is equally fun. But again, I find that the simple sight gags are the most efficient, and thus it makes them prone to some less than polite laughter, such as in the case of one of my favorite things to see, Different Strokes.
I've lost the feeling in my arm.
All of a sudden I can't see anything.
Sunday City, Different Strokes.
So I can hear you out there. Chris, how was Stay Tuned received? Well, critics were at best tepid, and at worst, they were outright dismissive of the picture itself. The common through lines were focused on the dated jokes and what was deemed as being needless parody. Yet, solid agreement was established amongst most of the critics that the best part of the film was actually the Chuck Jones animated segment, so you got that going for you. Stephen Holden of the New York Times thought that the concept of the film itself was clever, but thought that the overall parody lacked real bite, stating that, unfortunately, with most of its takeoffs, the black and white gangster film, the spaghetti western, the period swashbuckler, all show no true feel for the genre and thus no genuine wit. He did go on to praise the animated segment and, what's more, to give compliments to the Salt and Peppa music video, but he would bemoan that both Ritter and Dauber here didn't have much to do in the film except to, quote, be frantic. Variety didn't pull any of its punches either. Critic Joseph McBride took it to task, quipping that it was not diabolical enough for a true black comedy, and it was too scary and violent for kids who were lured in by its PG rating, and its witlessness in its send-up of obsessive TV viewing. Stay Tuned is a picture with nothing for everybody. Now, McBride also would cop to the fact that the premise of the film had some real potential, but felt that the parody elements of the TV shows fall flat, noting that the bright spot remains the animated sequence. Are you yet you're detecting a pattern. I mean, really. Now, not everybody was completely dismissive. Dwayne Burge at The Hollywood Reporter noted that this was a nimble poke at TV Land, a film that was at least to be popular amongst kids as an amiable end-of-the-summer film, a bit of light refreshment that makes good fun at, quote, suburbia. Now, Rita Kempley of The Washington Post also took what was offered here in stride, commenting that what we get here is wonderfully silly, a zippy action spoof with the consequences being both remote and out of control. In the end, though, what the critics said wouldn't quite matter. You see, Stay Tuned opened on August 14th, 1992, coming up against Digstown, Single White Female, The Living End, and Johnny Suede. Out of which, Single White Female would carry that weekend's release, still coming in third to audiences who were flocking to see films like Unforgiven, Death Becomes Her, and barely edging out A League of Their Own. Stay Tuned would earn a paltry $12 million at the box office against its $25 million budget, and it would quickly slink off into the realm of being a cult film rental, where it would, over time, grow in prestige over the years to a dedicated group of fans. I have to say, though, while I do take some offense to people looking back on the film from now, commenting and using the adjective that it is dated. Why? Well, first, let's be practical. When you look back on anything from several decades ago, by its very nature, it's going to be, quote, dated. So when you say that, you just come off sounding stupid. No, to me, what really needs to be taken into account is for people, when they watch this film, to acknowledge the fact that we, as viewers, consume television very differently than we did then. TV has radically changed over the years. Seriously, I'll use my own life as a case study. There's only 7 years between my kid sister and myself, and my own on-the-spectrum behavior aside, that difference in what was on and what was available to her, oh, let's stick with the just generic age of 7, was wildly different for her in 1996 than it was for me in 1989. Because network TV and local UHF stations, reruns for them were everything. It wasn't just relegated to being the stuff of Nick at Night. To account for the need of filler material, television stations would put on old movies and reruns, and those would be slotted in on the regular to take up space, something that truly isn't done that much anymore, in part due to licensing for content changing, but more importantly, the dual boons of the cheapness of video production and the rise of reality TV in the mid-90s to present day. Stay Tuned was parodying a time when we could still turn on a general TV station at 1 in the afternoon and see something like Mr. Ed on a local station as content filler. So the shows that it's parodying were somewhat ubiquitous at the time. In addition to making pokes at those trendier content that it was spoofing, stuff like 30-something and Northern Exposure, yeah, that's great. But as you look at it, this was something that was kind of, again, across the board, something everyone could relate to. And while it will list, if you go online, various films and shows that get spoofed, especially if you go to things like IMDb or Wikipedia, the majority of the titles that are listed here as being spoofed in Stay Tuned show up as place cards at the end credits of the film, with the viewer actually never having seen a parody of them, just something that's a joke title, which makes some of the criticism received over the years as being overly disingenuous. Case in point, you never actually get to see the parody of I Love Lucy, which is I Love Lucifer. So you can't claim what's being shown here is old and tired when it's never even showing up in the first place. I mean, honestly, just think about it again, put it in context, how much TV has changed with channels and providers getting more and more territorial over where their content is released and what can actually be accessed and streamed nowadays. Your run-of-the-mill 10-year-old who knew Wayne and Garth from SNL, would they know them now? The way an average 10-year-old in 1992 would be familiar with the SNL characters from 20 years prior? Not likely. And it just happens because it doesn't show anywhere anymore. That's something, honestly, we should chew on for certain. Now, as far as legacy goes, though, this is a film that certainly made a serious impression on a number of creative people. At least as of this recording, currently, a television series adaptation of Stay Tuned is in the works and has been bandied about for the last 2 years, with rumors of show running showing up on Bloody Disgusting and on the website Den of Geek. Each of those sources claiming that the good folks at AMC are interested in picking it up, with, of course, the folks at Morgan Creek Productions backing and producing it as a forthcoming series that will fill in for the coming changes as popular shows like Better Call Saul and Fear the Walking Dead wrap. On that note, it's interesting to point out that Ian Goldberg, of Fear the Walking Dead fame, has been collaborating with friend and writer Richard Yang. They got together and wrote The Autopsy of Jane Doe. They're going to create a horror comedy series that will involve a remote that, of course, leads you to several different television parodies of hell. I personally don't think it sounds like a good fit, but hey, I'm open-minded. Let's see where it goes. What's the harm? Look, here's what I can tell you. Stay Tuned is not a film that's going to change your life, nor is it a film that is something that's going to be bust-a-gut funny. But when you watch something like this, you get a fun, albeit dark, little confection that has some really cherished actors having a hell of a lot of fun with a bunch of different tropes. And that makes it something that is both unique and special to be seen. Especially during these times, where all people are attempting to make a bunch of blockbuster comic book adaptations, looking for franchises to kickstart, rather than making something that is unique, quirky, and fun. And for that I say, Stay Tuned is well worth your time. The version of Stay Tuned screened here at the LSCE was the 2004 DVD release put out by Warner Brothers, and that comes with a very small smattering of extras, which include behind-the-scenes promotional featurettes, theatrical trailers, and a promo for other Morgan Creek releases back in the day. It hasn't officially gone out of print per se, but copies of the Region 1 DVD are actually rather hard to find new out there in the wild. Z Shops on Amazon will list them as being available, sealed, new, for an average of $30 a pop, which, well, I'll tell you, yeah, I like the film. I will also tell you to your face, you are paying far too much for that. Now, all of that said, in 2019, a new Blu-ray release was put out again by Warner Brothers, and while there are plenty of those available, it was oddly released with even less things on the disc. Things like subtitles have been removed, and what's more, there's no longer trailers to be seen, so all you have left was the film and a behind-the-scenes featurette. That said, it's still far more reasonably priced, and you can get a brand new copy on a Blu-ray disc for $21.86, a throw on Amazon.com, which I would tell you, yeah, that's at least more worth your time. Now remember folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE to tell you where you should purchase your films from. We just feel in this day and age it's ever so important to continue to support physical media, so that these fine companies who own the rights for this marvelous content will keep releasing what we the consumers love. And at the end of the day, isn't that really what you want? More of this marvelous stuff that you love? Besides, Stay Tuned is such a weird throwback to a time that we'll never get to experience again, and that makes it a nostalgic romp that masks a really dark streak with some seemingly silly sight gags, the kind of which you need to see to appreciate. So I say all that to say, what are you waiting for? Get out there and get yourself a copy of Stay Tuned today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. We do hope you will listen again. I have an announcement to make regarding future planning for the podcast. So, with few exceptions, we have been pretty steadfast in coming at you each and every week with new content, new films, new themes. Something that we are very happy to be providing over the course of the last 4 years, and something that we truly do still want to keep continuing. That being said, though, I would like to announce the following plans for the future. I Saw It on Linden Street is planning on launching a theme that is going to take us across the entirety of the summer of 2022, something that we're going to call the Summer of Canon, and that's going to be a loose collection of films that is going to showcase the historic rise and fall of the Canon Film Group, spanning the entire decade of the 80s, specifically 1980 through 1989. We plan on doing a deep dive on the company, their history, the players, and the range of selected films that they put out during that time. And of course, hopefully we have some great guest contributors and some fun facts for you to enjoy for some great grade B schlock. Now, all of that said, to do a proper job and to allow me to recharge my batteries a little bit and take care of some of the commitments I have with my day job that actually pays the bills on this raggedy place, I'm going to tell you flat out, I Saw It on Linden Street is going to be taking a hiatus for the month of May before coming back with a vengeance in June, highlighting the Summer of Canon. We didn't want you thinking we were abandoning things or giving up in any way, shape, or form, but truthfully, we need a little stretch of time to deliver something of quality that we do hope you will enjoy. So all of that said, I do hope you're going to come back and join us then. That said, if you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Dachshunds and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a shout out on the show. Just think of it as my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Please swing by and check out our website, thelscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. We've also recently been added to Stitcher, so you can find us there. Give us a spin if you like. I'm also proud to say that we're on Amazon Music, so if you have an account, you can simply say out loud, "Hey, Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured on both Podchaser as well as Good Pods, and those are podcast databases for listeners and creators alike. You can find us there, give us a follow and a review if you please, and hey, feel free to like any of the lists that we're a part of to help give us a boost in the old rankings. You see, the more reviews and the increased likes in these marvelous places, that tweaks those algorithms that makes us a little more searchable, and then we get to share more of these films with more people. And you want us to do that, don't you? Of course you do! Do you have any questions for us? Any comments? Any movies you want me to cover? Any things you think I got wrong? Well, guess what? I'd love to hear from you. Please, send us an email or an audio clip by way of LindenStreetCinemaExperience@gmail.com. Do you love social media? Well, hey, we use it here. You can follow us on Twitter @LSCEP, or you can find us on Instagram @LSCE_podcast, or go to Facebook and find us at Linden Street Cinema Experience. If you'd like to be more personable or you wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, it's not a problem. Please send us an audio message by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app to use. So, until next time, which is gonna be June, please take care out there. Please stay healthy and well. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
Now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon.